Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly source of tech news, game reviews, movie reviews, classic movies, local events, and you can even win stuff. On this week's episode, we have a look at the new Foxtel Play app that has just launched on the PlayStation platform. I apologize, we have to get serious with the tech news with some concerning laws looking at being introduced in Australian Parliament. We'll have a look at the new Ubisoft game, Child of Light, and Christian will pay a visit to some mystery movies of the past. I have a look at Amazing Spider-Man 2, and reach back into the almost bottomless bucket that is video game to movie adaptation. In the local wildlife section, we have a very special guest and a rundown on a number of events happening around Brisbane in the next couple of months. And don't forget, there's prizes too. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. For something a bit different this fortnight, I thought I'd talk about Foxtel Play and its recent launch on the PlayStation 3 and PlayStation 4. I managed to get my hands on a free trial of this service, so I decided to have a closer look so I could let you know my impressions. It didn't get off to a very good start. The application itself on the PlayStation 3 suffers from the old you can't register directly through the application. To sign up, you do need to log into a computer and fill out all your details there in order to get your login for the application that you actually wish to use. This ends up being, I guess, a bit more convenient because the amount of text fields you need to input, I guess it is easier on a keyboard. Now, the Foxtel Play service had the big promise of, hey, just $25 a month. Well, that $25 a month isn't going to get you a great deal of stuff. At the end of the day, even if you go for everything, it's still cheaper. You're not paying for a Foxtel box, you're not paying for installation, so I guess you'll save some dollars at the end of the day, but your $25 will get you about a quarter of a Foxtel basic subscription package. As you add more stuff in, it generally brings down the cost a bit, but if you end up clicking on everything, then it's $100 per month. So what does this money get you? Well, the four basic packages you can choose from are grouped under entertainment, drama, documentary, and kids. It does give you, I guess, some flexibility with what you choose, but if you want maybe a couple of the entertainment things and some of the kids stuff, you're still basically paying for two different packages. It does offer a bit of a bulk buy discount, so if you want to get all four of them, it's going to cost you $50 rather than $100. Then you can also add on your premium picks. Now these are definitely both on top. You've got your choice of sports and the premium movies and drama, which would be the one for you Game of Thrones fans out there. So now you've made your choices, filled in the overly long registration form, got your password, got your confirmation email. So what is the experience you're going to get using the actual Foxtel Play app? At first look, it's a bit daunting. There seems to be very little in assistance in finding programs. There is a search function, but unless you know specifically what you're looking for, it's not really that useful. Browsing through the live channels and the on-demand content isn't the smoothest experience either. With only a few lines of channels, or four items of on-demand content on screen itself, requiring further scrolling, it's not the sort of thing where you're going to find what you want at a quick glance. A little more investigation into the options, and you can sort by genre with regards to the TV channels and the on-demand catch-up content. You can also sort the catch-up content by channel as well. The quality, while not being full high def, is decent, and watching live TV is a mostly smooth experience. I did notice that playback on the catch-up content, I chose to watch They Live, the John Carpenter classic, did have occasional, I suppose you can call them micro-pauses, where It just seems to be that the stream itself just needed a half a second to catch up with the viewing. But it wasn't all sunshine and roses. While watching the on-demand content of the movie, I discovered something very, very disturbing. I found myself in a situation where I had to pause the movie, so just assuming that it would work much the same as other content, I picked up my PlayStation remote and hit the pause button. Nothing happened. Nothing at all, it just kept on playing. By going back to the main menu, I saw that it had the option to resume rather than play, but then when I resumed it, it went back a fair whack in the movie, so it wasn't really a smooth resume. I later discovered that by pressing the triangle button on the remote, I could bring up an on-screen menu, which then gave me the fast-forward, rewind, and pause options. So it appears that the Foxtel guys behind this app decided that they only had to worry about people using a controller to navigate. The PlayStation Remote is pretty ubiquitous when it comes to PlayStation set up as entertainment units. So this definitely is a big oversight from the developers. And I'm afraid I've also got a bit of bad news for you sport lovers out there. If you intend to pay the extra $25 for the sports package, you're going to be a bit disappointed. When we hopped on to one of the sports channels to watch a bit of footy, the video quality was noticeably poorer than the general TV or on-demand content. All the players on the field looked like that they were kind of fuzzy, and the actual playback itself just wasn't smooth. It was like it was dropping a number of frames, and it was very, very distracting, and not a good watch. What really made me give up on watching the sports broadcast is that when an ad came on, it was in much better quality than the sports itself. And remember again, this is an extra premium package to get this content. So will I be continuing with my Foxtel Play subscription once the 14-day trial is up? No, I won't. It may be that I am spoiled by the ease of use of services like Netflix, but for the price they're asking, even for the basic package, I do expect a much better experience. Navigation is clunky, and at the end of the day, the price they expect you to pay for the content on offer, well, again, a little bit of internet trickery can get you a lot more content at better quality at a much lower price. Even if you're a big sports fan, which is pretty much the main reason that most of the people I know have Foxtel, expecting to pay $50 a month for access to a service where the broadcast is a lower quality than the ads is still a bit too much to ask. So if you do want good subscription content, I'm just going to fall back to my standard recommendation. Get yourself on Netflix. I'd like to start this next story with an apology. I know I said I'd try to keep stuff in the tech news a bit more lighthearted and easygoing, but unfortunately recent developments prevent that. You may remember that back in February, Federal Attorney General George Brandis said in a speech that he was looking at the introduction of a three strikes graduated response policy and the possibility of blocking internet sites in response to pressure that his department was receiving from the movie studios due to the high level of piracy in Australia. He also said that he'd like to see the internet providers and the content industries come to some sort of agreement over this. But again, saying that his preference was on these particular draconian measures, and saying that if agreement wasn't reached, then he would introduce the measures himself, kind of made that a bit of a moot point. Well, now it is definite. In an article published in the Sydney Morning Herald on Monday, it was reported that the Attorney General had apparently made up his mind on the issue, and he was intending to table two proposals to Federal Cabinet. One would be that internet service providers will be required to issue warnings to people who repeatedly download illegally, and the other one was to force internet providers to block file-sharing websites such as the infamous Pirate Bay. But seriously, how effective are these sort of measures? Well, considering that they are looking purely at BitTorrent traffic with regards to file sharing, which is the most easily tracked sharing on the internet, since everyone's IP address is open to anyone else to see. So if looked at purely from a BitTorrent traffic point of view, I dare say that introducing these measures will see a reduction in the amount of BitTorrent piracy undertaken by people. But I think at the end of the day, if you look at actual piracy figures, it's not going to make any difference. I am willing to bet that whatever reduction in piracy figures claimed by the content industries due to this legislation, we will see a much bigger respective uptake of services like seed boxes, VPN services, and Usenet subscriptions. I'm also happy to bet that in a very short space of time, we will see a plethora of articles aimed at Australians about how to bypass these sort of restrictions. All this legislation is going to do is direct people to other forms of file sharing that can't be so easily tracked by the big studios. The movie industry really needs to walk away from this fascination of how can we reduce piracy. And they need to focus more on how can we actually increase our profits in this new marketplace. The evidence is there. Music piracy has dropped considerably since the advent of iTunes and Spotify gave cheaper, legal alternatives for people to obtain digital copies of their music. Video game piracy dropped immensely when services like Steam made buying, installing, and playing games a much more convenient prospect than what the pirates were offering. No longer did you have to sit through multi-disc installs and inserting 16-digit keys in order to access the stuff you just bought. Nope, you buy it on Steam, it downloads, and you play it. It's not hard, it's not rocket science. You see, these sort of measures are not driven by the desire to protect the artist. They're driven by the greed of the distributors to keep their part of the pie. In a digital age, you can't stop stuff from being spread around. It's not going to happen. If you try to hold something back in order to maximize your profit in different release areas, then people are going to find alternatives. If you insist on charging 3 to 4 to 5 times the amount for content, for ticket prices, for anything in a different region, when the internet can show those people how much cheaper and how much more content is available overseas, of course they're going to bypass your distribution method. It's insane. Look, the impact of this at the end of the day and why we as Australians should be fighting this is that if this legislation comes through, if this is passed and this goes through, do you know who's going to have to pay for these schemes? It won't be the content industry who've already invested over $4 billion towards donations to the coalition party. Oh no, no way. It's going to be expected that the internet providers wear the cost for this scheme. And if the internet providers have to pay for the cost of the scheme, do you know where they're going to get that money from? That's right, our pockets. Essentially, the Attorney General is more than happy for each and every Australian to have to pay a higher internet bill just so he can keep the content industry happy and make sure that they keep making their regular donations to the coalition party. The same people that put on a special advance screening of the Lego movie for our politicians a month before the rest of Australia was allowed to see it, which is incidentally 2 to 3 months after the rest of the world got to see it as well. Now, I do try to keep this podcast pretty family friendly, but if you don't want to hear rude words, or you don't want to let your children hear rude words, then I suggest you skip the next minute of this podcast, okay? Final warning. So to the Attorney General, George Brandis, to the movie companies pushing this method that simply does not work, for everyone out there who supports a scheme that's just going to increase the bills of the Australians for no actual benefit at the end of the day, I have only one thing to say. Fuck you. We now resume our normal happy programming. Thanks a lot.
Child, tuck yourself in bed and let me tell a story of Lemuria, a long-lost kingdom, and a girl born for glory.
Child of Light by Ubisoft is a very interesting beast. A lot of the promotion material behind it really pushed the fact that the developers were the same ones that worked on Far Cry 3. It also uses the same game engine that powered the excellent Rayman Origins and Rayman Legends. But this strange child of Far Cry and Rayman is a far cry, no pun intended on that one, from what you might expect. Child of Light sees you play the role of Aurora, daughter of an Austrian duke from 1895.
In Austria was a crown land ruled by a duke. Aurora was his daughter, child of a duchess mysterious, beloved by her father.
The introduction, all told in rhyme, tells the story of how Aurora ends up in this mystical land and charged with bringing the sun, moon, and stars back to bring back the light to the land and ultimately reunite her with her father. To be honest, the introduction gets a bit bleak. You can't really say that it's a very happy start to the game.
For all intents and purposes, Aurora was dead. And yet, once upon a time, she awoke in a strange land instead.
And right from the start, there are some very strong suspicions about what this mystical land might be and how it reflects what was discussed in the introduction. Now, the first thing you're going to notice about this game is the rhyming. The intro, every bit of dialogue, pretty much as they possibly can, is all told in rhyme. Most of the time, this really isn't too much of an issue, but there are some conversations that do get a bit convoluted in an effort to keep the rhyming going. The next thing you're going to notice is the art style, and this is one of the areas where this game really shines. The entire world has an almost watercolor feel to the graphics, and especially once you unlock the ability to fly, the fluidity and the smoothness of the graphics, well, it really does turn it into a work of art. This is one game where simple graphics work wonderfully with the sort of atmosphere that they're trying to create. These visuals are very well backed up by the music, which is very ambient, very soft, and quite a pleasure to listen to. Okay, so we've worked out that it looks great, it sounds great, and the dialogue is a bit on the wonky side. But I suppose the important thing is, how does the game play? At its heart, Child of Light is a 2D platforming role-playing game, but it's one where the role-playing game staples of inventory management, skill trees, and leveling up is actually handled quite well and doesn't get overly complicated. The skill tree is very simple to navigate and does give you the flexibility to develop your character in your own way. The inventory screen is uncluttered and very clear, and there's even a rudimentary crafting system, which allows you to give bonuses to yourself in combat, whether that be as attack or defense. And it's probably the combat is where most people are going to, I suppose, come on one side or the other with this game. The fighting system seems to be very heavily influenced by games such as Grandia and the earlier Final Fantasy systems, where attacks are determined by how fast a particular character or creature moves along a timing bar at the bottom of the screen. Once a certain line is reached, that character or creature can then attack. But it doesn't stop there. As Aurora gains friends who can help her in combat, you'll see an interesting variety in the manner of the attacks. Most moves or spells or abilities are given a time frame, whether they are short, medium, or long times to perform the action. This adds an extra layer of strategy to proceedings, because if you start doing a move that takes a bit longer to complete once you hit the attack area, and a enemy with a faster attack manages to get in before you finished, it interrupts your attack and actually moves you back down the timeline. meaning you have to wait longer before you can try to attack again. Fortunately, this also works the opposite way around. So clever use of fast attacks combined with the more powerful long attacks can actually mean you can do some pretty serious damage without letting the enemy even land a hit. You're also assisted by a firefly. Yep, a firefly in a role-playing game. That seems strangely familiar. Who can be used in combat to temporarily blind, in a way, the enemies, which slows down their progress along the action bar, both as they are waiting for attack and the attacks themselves. It may sound like there's a lot involved, but it is a deceptively simple combat system that allows for some quite sophisticated tactics. It is impressive. Where it falls down, though, is that it also gets quite repetitive. As you play, you do get companions, but only one of them can fight with you at any one time. You can swap your companions during combat, so this also means that as you play the game and you can work out which enemies are weaker against which characters, you can tailor your attacks accordingly. Outside of combat, this is very much an exploration game. Now, it's not open world. You are pretty much set down specific tracks that you must follow, but there are plenty of side passages where you can find extra treasure and items to help you along your way. Additionally, there are some pretty basic puzzles involving either the moving of blocks to activate platforms. There's a bit of clever timing involved with some of those. Plus, there are light and shadow-based puzzles which you use a firefly for. None of these puzzles, though, are all that arduous, and they're not really going to slow you down all that long. So really, Child of Light, well, it is a good game. How much enjoyment you get from the game, it really is going to come back to how much you enjoy the combat. Also, remembering that outside of the fight scenes, it is a very laid-back experience. And, well, the rhyming will, on more than one occasion, drive you a bit batty. It definitely is not a game for the action junkies, but if you're after a well-presented, beautiful-looking, lovely-sounding, more thoughtful role-playing game, then Child of Light could certainly fit that bill.
It was the Great Friday before Easter 1895. Players performed for the Duke, his new bride at his side.
Okay, now last podcast we brought you 80s kung fu movies, Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee. This time we're going to look at something a bit different, that dubious movie genre, the Agatha Christie movie adaptation. Now I've decided to look at the period from 1974 right through till 1988, the period in which Peter Ustinov played Hercule Poirot, all times except for one, in which the first time in 1974 was Albert Finney. I grew up reading the books of Agatha Christie. It's so funny when I see these movies and remembering, you know, me sitting in the windowsill as a little kid with all these books clutched firmly in hand. Once I'd read all 80 of the Agatha Christie books, it was time for me just to start all back over again of the collection. And I really enjoyed that period of my life, being able to delve into this. Even though I do recall seeing the Agatha Christie movies as a kid, I only remember bits of them, and it was really interesting. About 2 weeks ago, I decided, right, I'm in the mood, I'm going to have a bit of an Agatha Christie marathon. So I watched all the films of that period back to back. The Agatha Christie movie adaptations are not new. You know, since the 30s, they'd been adapting, you know, 10 Little Indians, and then there were none. There's been a few adaptations over the years, even a movie about the life of Agatha Christie when she disappeared in the later half of her life. But it was 1974's Murder on the Orient Express, which really helped form the template for what the Agatha Christie movie adaptation should be like. Very big budget, classy people, famous actors. Usually had a cast list that made look very impressive. And it was really interesting seeing all these big names working together. And in many ways, probably their only movie together.
It was found in an ashtray by the dead man's bedside.
Then someone planted it there.
He did it. The butler did it.
A lot of Agatha Christie's books were adapted into movies in the 30s, and in 1956, for example, there was the ABC Murders, which was released by Frank Tashlin, who did The Girl Can't Help It. So up until that point, they were very much flashy and I suppose few and far between. But it wasn't until 1974 with Murder on the Orient Express, probably the first major movie adaptation of her work, that we were able to see, I suppose, the template form of what essentially these adaptations would follow for the next 14 years. Peter Ustinov plays Belgian detective Hercule Poirot in every movie except the first one, which is played by Albert Finney. Really interestingly, though, Albert Finney, this was the only time he played the character, he was actually nominated for an Academy Award, the only time an actor playing Hercule Poirot has done this. Murder on the Orient Express really stands out as one of the key Agatha Christie books, and as a result, the movie adaptation became quite popular. It really set up the feeling of, you know, isolation. You know, the books usually revolved around a famous person or a group of famous people, and they manage to get caught in a situation. They might be in a house where no one can leave. They might be in a train, in the case of Orient Express, which is caught in a snowdrift. This sets it up perfectly as these being the only suspects. We are then treated to interrogation of all the characters. We get to see a lot of flashbacks, and then at the end, Hercule Poirot will take everybody into a room, and for the last 20 minutes of the movie, do an analysis of what happened with flashbacks shown on screen, exactly what happened at the time of the murder. Now, as a fan of the books and a fan of this sort of genre, it's really exciting to be able to see them in this way. But Murder on the Orient Express really brought in the whole all-star budget. Very flashy. These characters are never, they're never lower classes of society. It's almost as though we get sort of enjoyment in seeing rich people kill each other. It was actually hard to get the rights to make Murder on the Orient Express, as Agatha Christie always felt that her previous adaptations didn't quite live up to, the original books. She was very displeased with Albert Finney playing Hercule Poirot. I believe that Murder on the Orient Express is really the best adaptation of Agatha Christie's work, and it really shows on where the golden age of the adaptations, which would continue for the next 14 years. Now, our first introduction to Peter Ustinov playing Hercule Poirot was with Death on the Nile in 1978.
You perfectly foul French upstart.
Belgian upstart, please, mother.
Very similar to Orient Express, it still featured an all-star cast. It's really great seeing Mia Farrow, Betty Davis. This one was shot on location in Egypt, so it was really great to be able to see all the different landmarks. They didn't just go straight onto a boat, and you know. And at first you were wondering, how are they going to make this a situation where, you know, only those people are the suspects? But of course, they go on the Nile for a cruise. Following on from Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile, Evil Under the Sun came in 1982. And this was probably one of the last, you know, one of those ones which featured people going on a holiday somewhere and something happening while they were sunbaking. In Evil Under the Sun, a rich heiress is sunbaking, and she's strangled to death by someone who goes past on a nearby motorboat.
Even in paradise, there is evil under the sun.
The film, which probably didn't sit the best with me, was 13 at Dinner, starring Faye Dunaway and Peter Ustinov. It felt a bit lackluster. It was interesting seeing actors like Bill Nighy playing one of the suspects, and then Faye Dunaway post-Mummy Dearest. I thoroughly enjoyed Murder in Three Acts. It was based on the 1934 book called The Three-Act Tragedy, and I felt that this one worked very well. It felt a lot like a Murder, She Wrote episode, you know, people that live on a canal in Miami, you know, all very rich. Someone gets poisoned when they all hand around the martinis. So it kind of made it quite interesting, the fact that every time these group of people would meet, someone would die, hence the name Three-Act Tragedy. In the final act, however, Hercule Poirot comes to the rescue and solves the crime. Essentially, what started off as a big-budget movie adaptation in the 70s with the Agatha Christie books, I felt by the 80s they just became television specials, and, I don't know, they didn't quite sit well with me. Definitely recommend Murder on the Orient Express, but if you want to look at these 80s movies, try A Murder in Three Acts with Tony Curtis. The last movie in this golden age of the Agatha Christie movie adaptations was 1988's Appointment with Death.
Something to do with roses?
Roses. Green fly. Spray. Syringe.
Syringe? To whom did it belong?
It was Carol Boynton's. She thanked me for finding it and took it with her when she went to fetch Ginevra.
It was like a last chance for them to get back and to these all-star casts, because in the last few that had happened in the 80s, they didn't really feature too many big names as they had in the 70s. So this one had Peter Ustinov, of course, Lauren Bacall, Piper Laurie, Carrie Fisher, Hayley Mills. But I felt it was too little too late. It tried so hard to be Death on the Nile, but just didn't quite get there. This list is by no means exhaustive. There's also other key movies with Margaret Rutherford. There's also The Mirror Cracked from 1980 with Elizabeth Taylor and Angela Lansbury. That's worth a check out, but they focus more on the other sleuth of Agatha Christie's, Miss Marple.
Lola, dear, you know there are really only two things I dislike about you.
Really? What are they?
Your face.
Well, there certainly is a plethora of superhero movies around at the moment, and funnily enough, most of them have the Marvel brand behind them. It's just that they're by different studios. After discussing Captain America the Winter Soldier from the Disney side of things, I thought it only fair to switch over to Sony and have a look at The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
That must be pretty cool, huh? To have the whole world see you like that. The Amazing Spider-Man.
The Amazing Spider-Man 2 sees Spider-Man, Peter Parker, played by Andrew Garfield, enjoying the life of being New York's favourite superhero. He's having a bit of a rocky time with his girlfriend, Gwen Stacy, played by Emma Stone, and there's quite a bit of back and forwarding between these two throughout the movie. Along the way, he finds out a bit more about his father. He tries to catch up and console his old friend Harry Osborn, played by Dan DeHaan, tries to unravel some of the mysteries behind the Oscorp Corporation, which Harry is now the boss of, and also has to contend with new bad guy Electro, played by Jamie Foxx. It may sound a bit garbled with his little quick synopsis, but let's put it this way, the plot on this one isn't the easiest one to describe. But hey, more on that later. One of the first things I got from this movie is just how much I liked the Spider-Man character. It's obvious that Andrew Garfield really enjoys playing this role.
You know what it is I love about being Spider-Man?
And that does come across with just the sheer exuberance in which he plays this role. I really didn't think all that much of the previous Spider-Man movie, so admittedly I did go into this one with low expectations. But hey, look, if Andrew Garfield's performance does not put a smile on your face, then I don't know what's wrong with you.
What happened to your face? It's filthy.
I was cleaning the chimney.
We have no chimney.
What?
He is ably backed up by Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy. These two seem to have a very nice chemistry, even though the character of Gwen herself is kind of a let's just put her in when it's most convenient or awkward.
This is bigger than you, Peter.
There really isn't a lot for Gwen to do, which makes it a bit more surprising that she plays a pretty big role in the inevitable fight between Spider-Man and Electro. Jamie Foxx as Electro is a bit of a different matter. Before becoming Electro, he's a very unassuming character by the name of Max Dillon. Everyone pretty much ignores him, and he paints a pretty sad character. Thing is, I actually liked Max Dillon and Jamie Foxx's portrayal of Max Dillon more than I did once he became Electro.
You okay?
You're Spider-Man.
Yeah, I know. Costume gives it away, huh, Max?
How do you know my name?
Your badge. Oscorp.
Nobody knows my name. I'm a nobody.
It's almost like he took it too far. Initially, when Spider-Man first encounters Electro, you still see some of that previous character. It doesn't take very long, though, for that character that you do kind of like to disappear. And all you're left with is this bad guy that you can feel no sympathy for.
How could you forget me? You lied to me.
The movie tries to do it, but he just goes so quickly from quirky and slightly sad guy to this merciless powerhouse. It really is a case where if they kept a bit more of that human element, I really think Electro would have been a much more compelling character. As for Harry Osborn and the stuff with Peter's parents, they really set the scene but don't go anywhere with it. Dane DeHaan does put in a good performance as Harry Osborn.
Peter Parker. Harry Osborn.
You're gonna want to see this.
Oscorp
had you
under surveillance.
But his big reveal, fairly late in the movie, again, does present us with a pile of very vague hints at what might be coming, and again, doesn't really go anywhere. And that leads us to probably what is the biggest issue with The Amazing Spider-Man 2. It doesn't really have a plot. I mean, things just happen. There is a lot of setup with a few big action scenes or chase scenes or fight scenes thrown in the middle, but very little happens. There's not even much lead up to the big climactic battle between Electro and Spider-Man.
You wanted to be the hero. Now you gotta pay the price.
It really comes down to stuff happens. Spider-Man chases something. Stuff happens. There's a fight scene. Stuff happens. Insert a transformation scene. At the end of the day, the movie doesn't really go anywhere. The only time you really get any sense of plot progression is right at the very end when, effectively, they're just setting up the sequels. In fact, the way the movie ends pretty much indicates that's exactly where they're going to start off from number 3. Even if you didn't like the previous installment, like myself, of this rebooted Spider-Man series, I still think you're going to get a smile on your face from some of the goings-on in this one. Just try to ignore the fact that it doesn't really go anywhere and the entire thing is purely set up for the sequel. It's fast-paced, it's got heaps of action, and it's always a good sign when you don't notice a 2.5 hour running time. But at the end of the day, it's going to leave you wanting more. There is no real sense of satisfaction at the end of this movie. So if you've already seen Captain America 2 and you're after another superhero fix that is, well, at least above average, then Spider-Man 2 should scratch that itch until the next big one comes along.
I like to think Spider-Man gives people hope.
Given that I like to find stuff to follow on with from previous podcasts, and the fact that Christian's little chat about kung fu fighting movies had a very notable exception, I figured that this week's redeeming features would have to be about the 1995 movie adaptation Mortal Kombat. Directed by Paul Anderson, or Paul W.S. Anderson, who really has a history when it comes to video game adaptations. I mean, he's been involved in the Resident Evil movies. He did Alien vs. Predator. He also did the other fighting game adaptation that I must admit to enjoying, DOA, Dead or Alive, which in itself could be the basis for another redeeming features segment further down the track. Mortal Kombat was an interesting beast, in that it actually took its plot pretty much straight from the game. This may seem obvious, but it's actually a bit of a rarity when it comes to bringing these sort of games to the big screen. Double Dragon decided to go with a post-apocalyptic environment, as did Tekken, whereas Street Fighter, which I'm not even going to attempt to redeem, my god, that's a bad movie, instead went with putting the characters in the middle of a civil war. So to have something actually based pretty faithfully on its source material is pretty refreshing in these circumstances. But is Mortal Kombat a good movie? Look, this is the redeeming features section. Why are you asking me that? Anyway, let's see if there are any redeeming features to get you to watch Mortal Kombat. Well, first and foremost, there's that theme song. You get to hear it right from the very start of the movie with a very punchy opening title sequence. And they don't let it lie there. They do revisit it a few times throughout the movie. They bring it back when the fighting starts getting underway and revisit it again for the start of the compulsory boss fight scene. This gloriously cheesy 90s techno track will even have you sitting through the credits singing along with it. Honestly, you know it's bad, but it's like chocolate donuts. They're bad, but gee, they taste so good. I was also quite amused by the compulsory visit to the warrior monk temple, and there's a shot of all the monks, from young to old, sorted by height. It's just in the background, but seriously, it is almost a completely straight line when you go down from tallest to smallest. It's brilliant. The visit to the monks also introduces us to one of the main characters in the story, Raiden, the Thunder God. Now, I think he is meant to be an Asian Thunder God. However, he is played by Frenchman Christopher Lambert.
One of you three will decide the outcome of the tournament.
It seems right up there with casting a Frenchman to be a Scottish Highlander in a movie where the Scotsman plays an Egyptian. Little Highlander reference for you guys there. But the joy of Raiden doesn't finish with the nationality of the actor. Oh no. There is Raiden's very dodgy, very large hat. Essentially, you could have four Christopher Lamberts having a group hug under this hat, and it would still be bigger than them. And finally, There's the wig. I don't know whose idea it was to come up with a white wig for Raiden that really does resemble a worn-out mop, but in a way, it's strangely brilliant. I personally feel that the movie would have benefited if they decided that the wig was actually another supernatural creature placed on top of Raiden's head to work against him during the tournament. Most of the characters in this movie are pretty much cheesy stereotypes, but let's face it, the original game itself was based on stereotype fighting characters. But there is a standout. An actor by the name of Trevor Goddard, who has quite an extensive career of minor roles in movies right up till today, plays the character Kano.
See me, I believe in a fair fight. You know, one-on-one, man-to-man, hand-to-hand, just like my daddy taught me.
He's a stereotyped, sleazy, bad guy, and Trevor Goddard seriously should get much more props. The way he pulls off this character is brilliant. I don't know what it is. He makes this slimy character actually seem enjoyable.
So then he freezes this guy, right? And then he explodes. I could see his guts and everything. Almost lost my lunch.
You know what? I think Trevor Goddard, if you ever do meet him, please give him a pat on the back or a nice, genuine applause for his portrayal of Kano in this movie. It really is something special. The token damsel in distress, Sonya Blade, played by Bridget Wilson, also has a very memorable moment. She's not really one of the more memorable characters. She's a one-note, I'm a tough girl who can look after herself approach, until, of course, she inevitably gets kidnapped by the bad guy and ends up chained up pretty much as a slave girl. I don't know if Paul Anderson was deliberately trying to echo Slave Girl Leia from the Star Wars trilogies, but that was certainly the impression that I got. And finally, as with most movies of this genre, there is the sequel stinger. But unlike most movies of this type, they actually did make the sequel. And after re-watching this movie, I actually want to finally watch the sequel. True, I am girding myself for ultimate disappointment from said sequel, but you know what? The movie still makes me want to see it, so that is definitely an achievement right there. I'd love to know if I've convinced you to revisit this movie. I will honestly admit that I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. Let me know your thoughts, and if you do end up watching this, let me know how you feel about me afterwards.
You will die.
Local wildlife. Well, as mentioned earlier, we've got a super special guest for this week's podcast. You've already heard from him earlier in the podcast, and you may have even been to a few of his events around Brisbane. That's right. This podcast, we're talking to none other than Christian Fletcher. Again, I'm still working on the whole outside recording thing, and there was a bit of background noise since we were recording in a public place. Don't let that put you off, though, because it's still a fantastic interview. Let's find out what makes Christian tick. Well, here I am in beautiful Post Office Square in Brisbane with my good friend Christian Fletcher. And as I just explained, I thought it was about time that we found out more about this mysterious voice you've been hearing on the podcast from time to time. So, Christian, welcome to the Roofies Project.
Thank you, Trevor. I thought you were going to say welcome to Post Office Square. Well, that too. Yeah, so yeah, it's actually interesting being on, the other side of the microphone, but probably not really. It's a different, being on the
other side of the recording.
Yeah, bullet. The responder. So thank you for having me on the Roofies Project.
Yeah, absolutely. Never happened before.
Yeah.
I thought it was about time that we asked you a few questions and found out a bit more about where you come from and what sort of things interest you and keep you going. So I guess to start with, you're known as the king of cult in Brisbane. So where did your interest in classic and cult movies start?
Well, it's interesting because I always grew up watching, or like, I think I was one of those kids that used to watch Wizard of Oz every day from grade one right through to grade three until I upgraded to some more serious movies. But I've always admired them. I always remember watching Bill Collins on Saturday Night TV. Back when watching TV on a Saturday night, to watch the movie was a really big deal. That's how I've discovered movies like Grease 2, Calamity Jane, every odds and end you can think of. And I think that's what really got me into movies. But it was when I started doing the Rocky Horror Nights in 2000 that I started to realise, wow, this is going off on a bit of a tangent, I realised that I'm quite interested in the presentation of film, and I thought, you know, why just focus on Rocky Horror when there's so many other great movies out there?
You may have already partially answered this.
Yeah, but you know, sorry, we can...
That's fine. So really, what did make you decide to stop just watching and start presenting?
Well, I got to a certain phase in around 2008 where I've been doing double features and a lot of stuff at a lot of pop-up cinemas and things, and I'd been running a lot of successful programs. By about 2008, I realised a lot of people were owning a lot of these classic and cult movies on DVD, so they were kind of coming to you going, you know, why would we want to come and see this when we could see it, you know, watch it at home in the comfort of our own, home entertainment systems. And that's what made me realise, wow, you need to have that little extra. It had worked so much with Rocky Horror. I think at that stage I delved into Little Shop of Horrors as an interactive screening. And it was then I started to realise things like Valley of the Dolls. We could have a jelly bean popping whenever people popped pills. Things like that. And all these different concepts sort of grew from there. So I think it really meant that you were more than just, you know, seeing the movies. You were showing them in a totally different way.
What have been the challenges with building up your reputation and getting some of the less-known titles back onto the big screen?
Well, without mentioning any names, I definitely would say the multiplexes are probably my biggest competitor with things. It's so hard now that with the advent and the introduction of digital with all cinemas, it now means that cinemas have are given a back catalogue of movies from the 30s right through till now that they can now screen. So there, in many ways, something that I was doing maybe 10 years ago, which was something innovative and new, the cinemas now... It's easy to go to the cinema and see West Side Story and Breakfast at Tiffany's now. It's not really, and I think that's what makes it quite hard to, you know, to compete, you know. But I think having that extra, having performers, you know, stuff that the cinemas haven't quite cottoned onto yet, shh, don't tell anyone. I think if things like that starting to happen, honestly, don't think they are. They're run by big corporations that really don't have any creative nous like that to even come up with things like that, to be honest. I don't want to challenge them, though, but I think that's what's been the biggest challenge, is trying to survive whilst being an independent film exhibitor, I suppose.
Being that independent film exhibitor, what was your breakthrough moment where you thought, hey, I can actually do this?
Okay, well, I know at a first Rocky Horror screening, I knew, well, I'd found the ultimate cult movie and the ultimate way to screen it. But I think it was around 2005, 2006 when I went from running movies every month at Metro Arts in the city. I went over to the Globe Theatre in the Fortitude Valley, which was the old Valley Twin, incidentally, where Rocky Horror had its premiere in Australia. So it was great to go back there. And maybe that sort of instilled me with a bit of creative ability to want to, you know, keep going and doing this sort of stuff. But it made me realise this is stuff that people wanted to see. We were getting to a stage where we had double features with queues around the block on a Wednesday night in Brisbane. That's when you started to go, wow, you know. And it's sort of getting back to what I was saying before about the, since DVD came out, unfortunately, DVD, Blu-ray, we were on that cusp where people started to go, we're not coming anymore. We've got this at home. Or you'd start to get people post you the link to download it off the internet. Yes, yeah, so thanks for that, supporters.
Very, very supportive indeed.
But I think it's been really the key thing is, and my background's marketing, so the really big key thing is keeping your audience and your regulars happy and keeping them involved, and I think that's the big thing. You'll come to one of my screenings and you'll always, without fail, aside from me, see a familiar face, because you'll have a lot of people that just, like a cult in itself, you know, a cult following. You know, these events have cult followings themselves because people want to come along and experience them. And the people that say, oh, I can just watch it at home, they're the people you probably don't even want there.
Yep, watch it at home. They're missing out.
Yeah.
I mean, being that, you know, hosting so many movie nights, I mean, you do stuff at Chanel, you do stuff at Room 60, the Luckalo Bistro, you've now the movie guy at the New Globe.
Yes.
And you also contribute to occasional podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just really wondering, where do you find the time for all this?
Oh, well, it's... After doing it for so many years, it's been 14 in October, you start to go, right, I'm sort of on autopilot now, okay, I need this, I need that, you know, I need to get the rights for this, but I'm doing a lot of pop-up screenings now, so, and that's really funny, just, you know, the day you're going through the list going, have I got the cord, have I got the movie, you know, and that's making it really kind of guerrilla underground, which is I'm really enjoying, but in finding the time, it all works in well together, I believe too, in a place like Brisbane, it's easy to make yourself a name, so I think spreading myself around to a lot of different venues means, yeah, I am the movie guy. And I don't know how I'd handle if someone else wanted to try doing it too. The competition might come out. But no, I definitely, I've had a lot of experience now over the last few years, so I can a lot of it I can do in my sleep. it's still just getting the audiences there that are the hardest and in many ways the most challenging thing about these screenings. So, but I keep doing it. Why stop doing something that at least somebody is coming along to see? So when zero are turning up, that's when I start to rethink about what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, we focus a lot on the movies so far, but you also do quite a few non-movie events, like the wonderful retrospect nights, 70s versus 80s, 80s versus 90s, always seem to pull in a big crowd. What made you decide to like branch out even further?
Well, it was interesting because after going from Rocky Horror to going to other movies, you know, all very retro, all very pre-90s in its feel, I started to go, wow, you know, there's probably interest out there in my audience in 70s and 80s music. I always grew up listening to it. I've been a huge 70s buff as long as I can remember. And so it was in 2005, I thought, right, I'm going to trial a night in Metro Arts, actually. It was when I was there at in the other side of the room, on the side of the venue, sorry. I had a room for the night, and I'm like, I'm going to trial this retrospect idea. Before I knew it, I had 130 people walk through the door. And that's what made me go, wow, I'm obviously doing something right. So we're 10 years next year of retrospect, and I think in the next few months, as you know, I'm having a few things are a bit up in the air with a few venues, I'm going to look at possibly doing retrospect in the suburbs. How about a tour, you know, going to those famous places, New Farm, Caboolture. So that'll probably be the future of retrospect, but it's really interesting how it all links in together. You'll see a big crossover from, say, the Rocky Horror and the cult audience coming to the 80s nights, because it's all that sort of age group. So I very much appeal to the 30-plus audience. That said, I don't detract from anyone else that wants to come along as well, because you know, definitely have a lot of young people interested, which is always encouraged.
Now, we have talked a bit about things like, you know, movies with performers and interactive screenings where the audience gets involved with Valley of the Dolls and stuff like that. And there's been a recent uptake in things like sing-along movies, like Little Mermaid and Frozen. In England, they have regular sing-along Mamma Mia's now as well. So do you think that this audience participation, this involvement in the movie, is the way for cinema to go?
Well, they've definitely cottoned onto a product that people know. And with these shows, like, for example, Mamma Mia and, I suppose, Frozen, now that the soundtrack's so popular, people like to be able to go to the cinema. Like when they go to a theatre and they see a jukebox musical like Mamma Mia, they love to be able to go and relate to something and be able to go along and sing along. For example, I'm actually probably dropping a bombshell here, but we're looking at doing Grease in a few months. That's you heard it here second on the Rufus Project. But so in the middle of August we'll be doing Grease with the Floor Show, but now we've got the option of when you ring up, almost like you're ringing up and ordering, you know, a car. I don't know, you're ringing up and ordering the rights. They go, do you want sing-along version or no sing-along version? So it's really interesting that they're now packaging that. So film distributors or the people that own these movies are seeing movies like Grease and Mamma Mia being so popular that they've gone, right, if we have the bouncing ball and the little words on the screen, it'll get people even more involved. And to be honest, I went to one years ago of Hairspray, even though I must admit they're a bit awkward when, you know, they're a bit under capacity, but the people that are there get so into it. It's even funny seeing people singing along. It'd be funny even with Mamma Mia singing along to the songs that are a bit obscure, sitting there and pretending they even know the words. But so that's, I think that, I don't think they'll go much further than just the sing-along thing. I don't think they'll ever get to the stage when they'll have full performers doing floor shows like we do with Rocky Horror. Because I think in the eyes of cinemas and distributors, that's been done. No, whereas I think this sing-along thing will be happening in the future because it's so easy. It's so easy for them to strike a print or a digital copy that has the words encrypted onto it. So, you know, sorry to take the shine off it by talking about it like that, but I think that's really how it's going to be.
Well, you've mentioned Grease, and I'm sure shortly after this segment in the podcast, we'll also have your little rundown of what's coming up. But is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to maybe just hint at or tease us with?
Okay, well, I'll give you one for each. I'll give you one for the movies and one for the music. In music news, we have, with retrospect, I'll be, as I said, taking it, doing retrospect in the suburbs. But another thing I'll be looking at doing is the 70s experience. It's a two-act, all-singing, all-dancing cabaret, which takes people on a journey through all 10 years of the 70s. And that'll be toured to RSLs and leagues clubs. You know, the same as your tribute shows that you see and things like that. So that's being written at the moment, and will be the next sort of big thing in that respect. Or retrospect. in terms of movies, things will continue at Room 60 in Lock and Load, but now that we are relaunching at the Globe, I can safely announce that we will be doing monthly screenings, and it won't just be B-grade sci-fi, which I seem to be quite known for recently. We'll be looking at doing things from James Bond Nights to This Is Spinal Tap with a rock band, things like that. So I've given you a few little hints here on what's on the possible program, so definitely head to christianfletcher.com, and we'll always try and keep you in in the loop with everything.
Sure. Now, just to wrap up and finish up with a strong movie theme. So, favourite movie and biggest guilty pleasure.
Okay. Well, favourite movie. Now, look. I've got a top 10 list or a top 9 list. I can't think of the 10th, but definitely the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls are a close tie. I've tried to make one beat the other. It just doesn't work, so they are a tie. But in terms of guilty pleasures, look, we've already delved into my obsession with Can't Stop the Music. Well, not obsession, but my admiration from... Gosh, it'd be easy for me to go Xanadu as well. But in terms of guilty pleasure, look, I love really badly dubbed Italian 80s sci-fi movies. In the wake of Star Wars in 77, there were so many. Probably one of my favourites was a bit called Escape from Galaxy 3, which was also called Star Crash 2, Star Crash being a film in the late 70s. And this is an Italian movie where these people land on planet Earth, apparently, but everyone's wearing Greek togas and they're all doing this really weird interpretive dancing. So, but yeah, I'm quite into that's a guilty pleasure, especially when they're wearing outfits that are so reflective of disco. So yeah, guilty pleasure, not to name one in particular, but definitely really bad Italian 80s sci-fi.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for taking some time out of your schedule and
no
sitting
worries.
Down and this fairly cool evening, yeah.
Yes. I'm actually about to head off to Room 60, as we mentioned before, for our one of our events. So looking forward to hopefully seeing our listeners there in the future too. We will be launching the program for that in June. So forget State of Origin night. Come to Room 60 that night instead. It'll be better. And you get to see the new program. And Roger Corman's Star Wars ripoff, Battle Beyond the Stars from 1980.
Nice. Very nice. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Trev.
Yeah.
Okay, so it might only be May and Brisbane's getting a lot colder, but I've got just what you need to keep you warm this winter in Brisbane. Let's have a bit of a look of what we've got coming up. On the week of May the 20th to the 21st, we've got a bit of a bad movie marathon happening over two nights. The New Globe Theatre in Brunswick Street, Fortitude Valley is reopening the cinema, and we're screening Teenagers from Outer Space and Catwomen of the Moon, two 50s B-grade sci-fi movies, which is so much fun with an audience. If you want something a little newer, what about the 1975 drive-in classic, The Giant Spider Invasion, which is screening at Lock and Load Bistro at Boundary Street West End on Wednesday the 21st at 7 p.m. Now, I do movies once a month at Lock and Load, so it's really exciting to be able to bring Bill Rebane's Giant Spider Invasion back to an intimate screening. So yes, May is quite slow. However, looking ahead for June, we have quite a smattering of different types of events. On the 4th of June, we have Roger Corman's 1980 Star Wars ripoff, Battle Beyond the Stars, which is screening at Room 60. Two big events at the Chanel. On the 17th of June, we have the 30th anniversary screening of the original Terminator from 1984. That'll be a lot of fun to be able to see on the big screen with a group of friends. And that Friday, we'll also have the Rocky Horror Picture Show with the Cards for Sorrow floor show. In between all that, we have a Smith's Night at Lock and Load on the 18th of June. And you're hearing it here first, ladies and gentlemen, keep the date aside. 29th of June, we are screening David Bowie and the Jim Henson classic, Labyrinth. As always, for details about upcoming events, visit www.christianfletcher.com or find Christian Fletcher on Facebook. Remember, that's Christian with a K-R. Back to you, Trev.
And it's competition time. That's right, this is your chance to get free stuff from us. We still have those DVD copies of the BBC series Small Island, starring Naomi Harris, Ruth Wilson and Benedict Cumberbatch to give away, and all you need to do is to hop on any of our particular sites and leave the comment, Island. Also, for a fun night out, if you want to head to the Lock and Load Bistro over at West End, on May 21st, Christian is giving away a double pass to the Giant Spider Invasion. To win this one, all you need to do is comment spider. So there you go. Jump on Podomatic, jump on the YouTube channel, comment on the Twitter feed, or comment on the Facebook page with either Island or Spider for your chance to win some pretty groovy prizes. Please enter. I'm starting to feel like I'm talking to myself with these competitions. Thanks for listening to the Rufus Project. As always, we've had an absolute ball putting this together, and I hope that you enjoyed it just as much. Please let us know what you thought, or even if you have any suggestions or requests for future episodes. And if you have an event that you'd like us to talk about in a future episode, let us know. We may even be able to feature you in the local wildlife section. So get in touch with us at The Rufus Project on Podomatic, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and you can also leave comments and reviews for us on iTunes. So until next time, I can't think of a witty ending, so feel free to add your own. See you next time.